Blog Talk Radio.
Congratulations, young ladies. You are the first class of air hostesses beginning this month, January 1931. You have been selected by Eastern Air Transport as the first 12 hostesses for our expanding passenger service. Just to give you a little background of our company, and then we'll talk about your role as an air hostess. Our company was founded by Mr. Harold Pitcairn in 1927. Pitcairn Aviation won a government contract to fly mail between New York City and Atlanta, Georgia, using mail-wing single-engine aircraft. In 1929, Clement Keyes, the owner of North American Aviation, purchased Pitcairn. In 1930, Mr. Keyes changed the company's name to Eastern Air Transport, and Captain Thomas B. Doe is our president. My name is Harold A. Elliott, the Vice President and General Manager. Mr. C.H. Dolan is Eastern Air Transport's Operations Manager. Eastern Air Transport Air Hostess Service Manager is Ms. Mildred Johnson, who interviewed and hired each of you in this first class. You'll receive your extensive training and report to Ms. Johnson for your assignments. Ms. Johnson will take over from here. I have some meetings to attend and will have to leave right now. Good luck, ladies, with your training, and welcome aboard Eastern Air Transport.
Thank you, Mr. Elliott. Hello, ladies. My name is Mildred Johnson, and I want to speak to you today about your role as an Eastern Air Transport air hostess. You were selected after a very thorough search through hundreds of applications because you fit the requirements and you meet the high standards this company has set for our air hostesses. Now, the air hostess is a new employment opportunity with our company, and we, Eastern Air Transport, will be one of the first in the industry to provide our travelers with this cabin service. It is a new idea, but we're not the first to offer this service since Boeing Air Transport started offering their travelers this feature just a few months ago. I believe we are the second to offer air hostess service. Now, I must remind you, the company is looking at how well the service is received as to whether or not it will continue or be continued after the first year. So it's very important that each of you put in your maximum effort to help make this a continuing service we'll offer to the traveling public into the future. Ms. Johnson, well, we need to know how these machines take to the air and what type of airplanes will we be assigned? No, but we'll teach you the aeronautical principles of flight that our pilots have to learn before they ever maneuver the controls of the airplane. And you'll start your service on the Curtis Condor, which will have a crew of three. There will be the pilot, the co-pilot, and one hostess. The Condor seats 18 passengers, plus there will be a seat for one hostess and the two cockpit seats for the pilots. You'll be assigned to fly between New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, and Washington. I may have a fear of being in the air because I do get squeamish when I go on the circus rides when they come to my hometown. Well, all of you in this first class may not be suited for an air hostess job, but we'll find out soon enough as we've planned for you to go first on the introductory flight along with our customers to see how you can adapt to this new environment. Now, I know you'll have many questions before we finish this classroom instruction. Let me tell you what you'll be doing as an Eastern Air Transport air hostess. Your role will be to carry out duties of a social nature. Excuse me, Miss Johnson, just what does that entail? Well, we may have passengers wanting to get up a bridge party as they travel on our comfortable passenger aircraft. You will be catering to our air travelers, to their needs, things such as making sure they have they're comfortable and they're assured of the safety of being airborne, serving hot coffee or perhaps a cup of tea and some tasty biscuits on certain trips, as well as offering them magazines and newspapers. Lunch will be taken at certain airports and not served on the airplane. For instance, on our southbound trip between New York and Miami, lunch will be in Richmond and dinner will be served at the Jacksonville airport. On the northbound trip, breakfast will be served at the Jacksonville airport and dinner at the Raleigh airport. These meals are served in the airport terminals at these cities. Does that mean that we need to bring our own lunch and dinner? No, not unless you want to bring your own. Food and beverage is stored in a hamper and a thermos and placed aboard the aircraft to be served to the passengers. There'll also be snacks for the crew included in the hampers, and there's no charge to our passengers for this extra service. Well, what are some of our other responsibilities? Well, the aircraft may have smoking compartments, or actually they do have smoking compartments, and you'll offer those that care to smoke a cigarette, perhaps some coffee or tea. You'll entertain the customer, such as playing a game of cards, engage in sprightly conversations, and generally relieve the tedium of the trip for tired businessmen, statesmen, or lobbyists. The idea is to make the passenger feel at home. Will we be required to dress in our own outfits? Well, I think you'll like the uniform that's been designed for you. It's smart, it's stylish, it's easy to move about in as you carry out your hostess duties. These delicate garments will certainly grace your feminine form and be most comfortable to work in. It has a skirt and a jacket ensemble, has a matching hat. All hostesses will dress in the same stylish clothing. You will also have seasonal changes in your uniforms, but you'll travel in complete comfort and cleanliness. Now, I'd like you to meet the chief pilot for Eastern Air Transport, Pilot E.H., better known as Pete Parker, Pilot Frank H. Giardone, and co-pilot Johnny Armstrong.
Welcome, ladies. I look forward to having you on my flights, and I know you will enjoy your new career as an air hostess. I suspect the co-pilots will appreciate your being part of our crew. You see, when we first started our passenger service, the co-pilot did all the duties you will now be assigned to carry out on the ground and in the air.
And that's in addition to what the pilot had me doing in the cockpit to assist him in flying the airplane. I'm not at all saddened in handing over to you the social side of the flight, but there is more than social activities you will be doing. By the way, I'm John Armstrong, Eastern Air Transport number one's co-pilot in the Condor aircraft.
Good morning, ladies. My name is Frank Giardone, and I will be your pilot. Upon boarding the passengers, you will also make sure their baggage is secure in the baggage compartment and the overhead storage shelves above the passenger seats. We may come upon weather disturbances, and you'll make sure that the passengers are seated and not standing up or moving around in the cabin. They may take a fall, and we don't want to have any accidental emergencies while in flight.
Now, we have a Curtiss Condor outside the terminal on the ramp that we would like to take you through as your first familiarization with the largest passenger aircraft in the country. I will walk you around the aircraft and tell you about the various components, and then we will go on board to see the cabin and the cockpit. I'll answer any of your questions while we are on board, so bring the writing tablet and pencils. This may be helpful during your formal training by your supervisor instructor in the air hostess school.
We'll meet you at the boarding door of the airplane right after your lunch with your instructor. And thanks for your attention. Once again, welcome to Eastern Air Transport. It is our first air hostess class of January 1931. You truly will love the flying as a new and exciting career, and I can tell you that many applied, but few were chosen.
Hello, folks. This is the Eastern Airlines radio show, coming to you live from all over the place. Let's see, we have Neil Holland, Bud Hescock, Margaret Barrs, all in Jacksonville, Florida, Steve Thompson in the Carolina Mountains. Let me see, did I miss anybody? Oh, yes, I did miss the most important person putting this on the internet radio. Our producer is Eric Otero. If you have any problems with your computer, there's a good chance Eric can fix it right over the phone. He has put many folks back online. He has fixed virus problems. He has restored software, even helped many understand popular software. There's hardly any problem with PCs or Apple computers that Eric can't solve. He has been in computer solutions for over 15 years and is highly recommended by the hostess here at the EAL radio show. I'm going to give you a telephone number to contact Eric in just one moment. Who else did I forget? I guess it was me.
Well,
I'm Jim Hart, and I'm here on the beautiful island of Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts. We're here to talk about Eastern Airlines and the memories and fun we all had while working for this great airline. And now let's rejoin Pilot Jourdan, Captain Co-Pilot Armstrong, and the first class of Eastern Air Transport air hostesses. Could you give me that telephone number for Eric, please?
Okay, Eric's phone number is area code 407-697-9735. That's area code 407-697-9735. And folks, if you have any computer problems that Eric will probably be able to solve for you in just a matter of getting on the phone with you and walking you through that. He's really a genius at the computer. So we missed one person, and that's Steve McDonald, and Steve is with us in Lake City, Florida. The class of 1931 arrives at the airplane with their instructor to meet pilot Frank Jourdan and co-pilot Johnny Armstrong for their Curtis Condor tour.
Okay, ladies, now come over here by the wing. Let me tell you about the airplane. It's 57 feet 6 inches long and 16 feet 6 inches high. Has a wingspan of 91 feet 8 inches. As you can see, the plane has an upper wing and a lower wing, and contrary to common opinion, the biplane surpasses the monoplane in popularity.
When Eastern Air Transport was studying the Condor, and before a decision was made to purchase the fleet of them for its passenger system, our engineers carefully went over every detail of the plane. The inherent strength and stability built into it greatly impressed them. The fuselage has steel trusses and beams, and the ceilings are well insulated. Every piece of metal that goes into the fabrication of the Condor is put through metallurgical and stress tests and will stand strains many times as great as they were called upon to carry.
Okay, now, ladies, come on up here by the engines. Now, these are powered by two geared Curtis Conqueror motors of 600 horsepower each, fitted with the three-bladed metal propellers that you see, which have a 13-foot diameter. Fully loaded with 21 passengers, baggage, and fuel, the Condor weighs 17,900 pounds.
Well, I'm a tad bit familiar with airplanes, so, gentlemen, how fast will this go?
It has a high speed of 138 miles per hour and cruises at 118 miles per hour. It lands at 47 miles an hour and climbs at 925 feet per minute, and it can fly a range of about 825 miles.
Well, sir, if it has a high speed of 138 miles an hour, why would you cruise at 118 miles an hour?
Well, ma'am, that's a very good question. All airplanes have a maximum speed that is designed so they will not cause structural damage to the aircraft. These speeds have been tested, and the manufacturer tells the operators what the ranges for best performance are. I understand one of you is a licensed pilot.
Yes, sir. My name is Beulah Unruh. I do have a commercial pilot's license, but I will assure you I'll not be bothering you gentlemen about flying this large airplane. I've only flown the engine-motored monoplane. I'll be perfectly happy serving our paying passengers in the cabin.
Well, then let's go up into the cabin and also take a look at the cockpit. Your supervisor and instructor have agreed to allow us to give you a flight over New York and New Jersey while we tell you about the airplane. And one of you will come up front and look out the cockpit while we're in the air. The others will be getting familiar with your new workplace with your instructor.
I'm so glad we're in this first class. It's so exciting what we'll be doing. I guess we're truly early pioneers in this new career as air hostesses. I wonder how popular it'll become or whether it'll be decided that it's not such a good idea. Mr. Gerardone, how long have you been flying with Eastern Air Transport?
I've been with the company about a year now. Chief Pilot Pete Parker was first hired by Eastern Air Transport, and I was the second one hired. Two co-pilots were hired to fly with us since the Condor requires two pilots to fly the airplane. We've added more pilots and co-pilots since I was hired, and you'll be meeting them as you are assigned flights. Now I'll turn you back over to your instructor.
Well, ladies, in addition to what you've been told about what you'll be doing for our passengers, you'll also become familiar with the geography along the routes served by Eastern Air Transport. All of you are familiar with the building, bridges, parks, beaches of the New York, New Jersey area, as you're about to see when we fly over some of these famous landmarks. But we want you to be able to point out when over Lindbergh's Farm in New Jersey and the spot where Washington crossed the Delaware, and when over Pennsylvania, make sure you show the passengers Independence Hall, the statue of William Penn above City Hall, the U.S. Navy Yard, Hog Island Shipyard. Next is Delaware and the Mason-Dixon line. Please point out when the airplane flies over Maryland in the Patapsco River stands Fort Carroll. This old fort is the approximate position held by the British warship on which Francis Scott Key was a prisoner during the bombardment of Fort McHenry a few miles up the river. When the rocket's red glare and the bombs bursting in air inspired Key to write the Star-Spangled Banner. The District of Columbia will hold many fascinated if you point out the Capitol, the White House, the Washington Monument, the Lincoln Memorial, War and Navy Building, Treasury Building, Arlington National Cemetery, Navy Radio Station, NAA, the Navy Yard. Virginia offers views to our passengers of Washington's homestead at Mount Vernon, many battlegrounds, the Quantico Marine Base. Next is North Carolina and its many tobacco factories, such as Chesterfield and Old Gold Cigarette Companies, which, by the way, we offer our passengers free of charge in our smoking compartment. Kings Mountain is also a place of interest for the passengers. South Carolina is home of King Cotton, and Georgia Stone Mountain will be an impressive landmark viewed from the large airplane windows throughout the cabin. And when you're over the coast of Georgia, you will want to point out the Golden Isles. Then entering Florida, it will be as if in the tropics in midwinter. But don't worry, you'll be able to recognize these points of interest as you accumulate air miles during your career. Now, do we have any questions? Yes, Ms. Johnson, when will we be, or will we be meeting any celebrities on our flights?
Yes, nearly every flight on our passenger line, we carry important people. Many are government officials. We occasionally also carry famous people. On a recent flight I flew on board was Jack Dempsey, the former heavyweight champion of the world. Also, we've seen Will Rogers, the popular humorist, Miss Helen Keller and her escort, Herbert Hoover, Mrs. Franklin D. Roosevelt, Amelia Earhart, Captain Eddie Rickenbacker, Governor of Puerto Rico, Theodore Roosevelt, Governor of Georgia, Richard Russell, and even some royalty.
Okay. Miss Unruh, why don't you come up to the cockpit with us as we start the motors and make ready for our hop over New York City skyline.
And as we take to the air, why don't several of you take your seats, and we'll give each of you a turn at being the air hostess for those seated.
Miss Unruh, do you mind if we call you Beulah? We like to be informal at Eastern, so please use our first names also.
Well, not at all, Frank. Please do so.
Johnny, the ground has given us the clear to start both engines. Will you do the start, please?
Yes, sir.
Hang on a second. I hear number one going. Number two. Start number two then.
of the northeast and then fly out over the Hudson River to give you a view of lots of interesting places. Your engine sound and look good on the instrument panel and notice that you have two sets of instruments to fly for. Two sets of pilots and another set for the pilot. You're probably familiar with some of them having pilot.
Yes, sir, I recognize the directional gyro, the compass, the bank, and the turn, the airspeed, the sensitive altimeter, tachometer, rate of climb, and, of course, the clock. But there are many engine instruments that are paired because we do have two motors.
Very good, Bueller. Now, let me go around the instrument panel for those you did not identify. Starting at the bottom, we have the fire extinguisher and selector. Next to it, the master battery switch, adjacent to the fuel valve, and ignition switches, the starter, and across the middle section of the panel is the amp meter, generator switch, light switches. Now here's your landing gear signal. And then those on the main panel are the air temperature gauge, fuel gauge, oil temperature, fuel pressure, oil pressure. Here's your engine head temperatures. And one that you will hear often, especially when we want our coffee, the most important one in the cockpit, the hostess signal.
Okay, Beulah, you can tell your friends in the back to take their seats for takeoff. And we'll climb up to about 2,000 feet for our short flight around the New York area and the harbor. Okay, we're ready to go. I'll push the two throttles to the tachometer 2450 RPM setting that I need for takeoff. Okay, that's all set. I need about 60 miles an hour for takeoff. Okay. About 15 miles an hour above our stalling speed. Now we'll just push the wheel forward a little bit to get the tailwheel off the ground and pull back just a small amount. Ah, we're in the air.
I'll watch for other airplanes in our area. Bueller, Frank will make a shallow turn when we reach about 500 feet and head out over Newark Harbor, and then New York Harbor, where you'll see the Statue of Liberty.
Oh, my goodness, I can see the Statue of Liberty coming into view. How beautiful it is. That must be the Governor's Island at the confluence of the Hudson River and the East River. I sure hope the girls are seeing these beautiful sights.
Okay, we'll now fly over Lower Manhattan, where you'll see the Brooklyn Bridge, and then over to the North Beach Airport in the Queens area. And after that, we'll turn left and fly over Rikers Island, over towards Central Park, and then come down the Hudson River from a bit south of the George Washington Bridge, which has been open for only 4 years now. And we'll land back at Newark Airport. Maybe we can get the other ladies to start coming up one at a time as we give you an aerial tour of this beautiful area. And again, from your pilots, welcome to Eastern Air Transport and what I'm sure will be a long and wonderful career.
By the end of December 1931, there were 12 hostesses, not yet called stewardesses, chosen by Eastern Air Transport. Among the first to fly with Eastern Air Transport were the following: Miss Olive Birmingham, Miss Madeline Moon, Miss Beulah Unruh, Miss Marion Cook, Miss Doris Frost, Miss Alice Van Hooven, and Mrs. Ann Porter Cullum took over from Miss Mildred Johnson as the chief of the air hostess service by the end of 1931. Miss Cullum's office is in the passenger terminal of Eastern Air Transport at Newark Airport. Over 5,000 aspiring young ladies applied for an air hostess job, which required the applicant to be between 21 and 25 years of age. Most were applying by letter, and others were getting influential persons to write on their behalf or calling in by phone. 4 years after Eastern Air Transport started its passenger service, Walter Brown, the Postmaster General under President Herbert Hoover, used his authority to control mail contracts on which all the existing airlines depended. He organized a cohesive national route system and was recognized as the one that established the U.S. airline industry as a powerful mode of transport and one that would lead to global dominance. Eastern Air Transport did well. It had to change its name to Eastern Airlines to comply with the terms of the new contracts, but it gained new strength. It not only retained its gravy run from the northeast to Florida, direct and via Atlanta, but it also was the successful bidder for routes from Chicago to Florida, and it gained an extension of its Route 5 to New Orleans. By the time the Airmail Act of 1933 became law, June 12, 1934, Eastern was in control of all the main routes east of the Mississippi, except for the northeast to the Great Lakes, and it was poised to take its place as one of the big four airlines of the United States. In addition to the highly lucrative route from the northeast direct to Florida, Eastern established an operational hub at Atlanta. This soon became an aerial crossroads, and the Georgian capital's airport was eventually to become the busiest in the world. Ladies and gentlemen, research for the show was documented mainly from the Pitcairn News Wing newsletter to all employees and was renamed Eastern Air Transport News Wing after the purchase by Clement Keyes.
The cast for tonight's show are as follows: Mr. Harold A. Elliott, Jim Hart, instructor Miss Mildred Johnson is Margaret Bars, pilot Frank Jardone, Steve McDonald, co-pilot John Armstrong is Bud Hescock, air hostess Miss Beulah Unruh, Margaret Bars.
Now, remember, you can call in. We'd love to have you do this and join in our conversation with us. You can call by dialing 1-213-816-1611, or you can call our toll-free number 1-877-572-1861. I'll say these numbers again. You can call either 1-213-816-1611, or you can call our toll-free number 1-877-572-1861.
Kind of interesting, the skit. We tried to keep it as real as we could, and that's why we did some research in the news wing of Eastern Air Transport. And some of the interesting material was actually about the air hostess, the first for Eastern Airlines, eventually to become Eastern Airlines, and the young ladies, the 12 original air hostess at the end of the first year that were hired. I think in that first class they had six, which we tried to portray, and the ones that were flying in that first group, as we mentioned, Miss Madeline Moon. She was the daughter of an Army chaplain and was a former art instructor in the Fort Riley School. And, of course, you heard Miss Beulah Unruh, and she held a limited commercial pilot certificate. They called it a limited commercial certificate, I think, until you gained a certain number of hours. Also, there was a flight, I want to keep saying flight attendant, so you have to stop me to get this back in the 1931 era. But the air hostess, Alice West, was her mother was a direct descendant of John Hancock, the signer of the Declaration of Independence. And also she was a relative of Martha Curtis, who was the wife of George Washington.
Really?
Yeah. And her father was an owner of several large New York hotels. Miss West graduated from Rosemont College. I believe that's up in that area. So it was interesting just looking at the backgrounds of some of these young ladies, again, between the ages of 21 and 25 to be hired by Eastern Air Transport. Jim or Steve, can I get some comments from you guys about what your thoughts were about those days? I know Steve McDonald has a lot of background in the Curtis Condor.
I can give you some background on the Condor, Neil. The number of Condors bought by Eastern Air Transport There were six original Condors, a model CO, and they were turned back. They were bought by TAT, but they were turned back into Curtiss by TAT, stating they were too dangerous for us. Transcontinental Air Transport was the forerunner of TWA. Curtiss reworked them and sold the same six original Condors to Eastern. They were renamed a model B-20, and that's what we used in the skit tonight. Curtiss then redesigned the Condor as the Condor II, or the model T-32, as they called it, and Eastern bought nine more of these. There are major differences between the B-20 and the T-32. The B-20 was a fixed landing gear, twin tail with a water-cooled Curtiss Conqueror engine, like the one on the skit tonight. The model for T-32, a much better airplane, had Wright Whirlwind air-cooled engines, retractable landing gear, and a single rudder on the tail. American was the other major airline to purchase the Condor II. Militaries worldwide made up the bulk of the 59 total purchases of the Condor II, and in total 65 Condors of both models were produced by Curtiss. As some points of interest, Glenn Curtiss took his last airplane ride ever in a Condor B-20, one of Eastern's airplanes that had been sold to Clarence Chamberlain. Admiral Byrd's first trip to Antarctica was in a T-32 Condor seaplane, and it sank March 2nd of 1935, and it's still in 250 feet of deep water, or deep, it's not deep, 250 feet of water in Antarctica today. It's a recoverable airplane if somebody wanted to go get it.
Wow. That was a pretty rugged airplane then for its type, all fabric and a lot of fabric, rather, and a lot of wires, of course, holding the wings and
I know you've got a good story about Frank Jerdone going into Atlanta, Neil. Why don't you tell us about that?
Okay, I will. First of all, we've got a caller on the air, I believe. So, caller, if you'd like to talk with us, we're going to activate your microphone. And who do we have on the line?
Neil, this is Steve Thompson. It may be me.
Hey, it is you.
I was just curious as to where this takeoff occurred tonight. What was the location of the takeoff?
Yeah, it took off out of Newark, Newark Airport.
I'm sorry, I didn't pick up on that.
And it took off and went over Newark Harbor and then over to New York Harbor and took the young ladies around. Of course, this was our imaginary flight, and we think that probably would have happened back in those days. I think Eastern Air Transport, part of their training, it was, according to what I've researched, a very extensive program. It didn't really say the length that the young ladies took their training, but I'm sure they put them through quite a bit, and much more than just being a social hostess on the flight. But I'm sure they knew about the safety of the airplane. And, oh, by the way, those airplanes, the first passenger airplanes that we flew, didn't have seat belts.
Whoa. That must have been fun and turbulent.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Steve McDonald.
No, you're right. You're right, Neil. No seat belts.
So that's why we said in the skit to make sure that everyone was seated so that if they were standing up and we got into a disturbance, a weather disturbance, that they wouldn't take a fall. I don't know about what year we actually added seatbelts, but I'm sure it was probably after a few flight attendants fell down to the floor
definitely.
And someone said, hey, we got to have ropes in here or something.
Exactly.
But, Steve, you got any other comments? Steve Thompson?
No, I was just reminded of an incident I had moonlighting when I was I went to pick up a DC-3 and in LaGuardia by myself in the early 60s, very early 60s, and I was based in Charlotte, and I took off out of LaGuardia by myself coming back to Charlotte, and I had to get a special VFR clearance out of there. And the weather was pretty marginal, so I figured, well, I'll just take off on 31, I think it was, and get over the river and get down on the river and head down and get out over the ocean until the weather cleared up and head for Charlotte. Well, in the meantime, since I had been up there, whatever it was, I was up there, I flew out of there in 57, there was a bridge that was built between Staten Island and New York, and it was called Verrazano Narrows Bridge. And I am heading south over the Hudson River, and I see a structure there that I don't dare go under, but whose top is up in the clouds, and I've got a real serious decision here to make. So I decided going under that bridge was not the prudent thing to do, so I pulled my nose up into the clouds and just guessed when I was over the other side and then pushed it back down, and I guessed right, fair enough. So.
I think I would have gone under it, Steve, and you would have had bragging rights.
I would have, yes.
Were you ferrying that airplane for the Delta Air Base down there in Charlotte? I'm trying to think of the Eastern captain that owned it.
Bob Itell?
He was not an Eastern captain. No, he was not. No, he. That's exactly who I was ferrying the airplane for, and that's who I ferried a lot of airplanes for, yes.
Bob Itell?
No. It was he was
no.
senior, way senior.
Oh,
Bob.
Okay.
I'll think of it.
Well,
I was thinking about the other night. Yeah, that's exactly who I was working for.
Okay.
Yeah.
Neil, this is Jim up on the island. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a youngster, apparently. 80 is my next birthday. And I just loved hearing the startup of those prop-driven engines. It just brought back so many memories. And I want you to know that my first airplanes that I was really involved with were the Martin 404 and the Convair 440. And those little babies, because we had so many short hauls, 40 passengers, 44 passengers, were perfect for that airplane. And I remembered one company, I don't think there's any problem mentioning the name, it was Combustion Engineering in Windsor, Connecticut. Combustion came to us and said, hey, listen, fellas, we have a lot of travel between Hartford and Chattanooga, Tennessee. Is there any chance you could put a flight on there for us? Would you believe we went to the scheduling people, and they put a flight on from Hartford to Chattanooga with a stop in Newark, and it was one of the most frequented flights that we could have had. I just love those two-engine jobs.
Yeah. Well, you know, Eastern actually did some advertising about the Condor and their passenger airplanes. And, of course, they use the Kingbirds as well and the Ford Trimotor and the Falkers. They were so impressed with the speed that these airplanes would give that they advertised 2 miles in 2 minutes. And so that was, 2 miles in, no, 2 miles.
That's right.
Yeah, that's right, 2 miles in 2 minutes. Somehow or another, it didn't sound right because on the 727, we used to say 8 miles a minute.
Yeah.
Eight miles a minute. So it was kind of interesting. But can you imagine taking that Condor, the flight attendants, flying a trip all the way from New York all the way down? Actually, it was the Newark area that was serving us. And by the way, in our skit, we used North Beach, up over North Beach in Queens area. Steve, you want to tell them where North Beach was?
Well, North Beach is, Floyd Bennett was next to North Beach, wasn't it? North Beach was where Kennedy Airport is now.
Well, North Beach was actually LaGuardia, where LaGuardia is situated now.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was built, of course, LaGuardia was really built with garbage in that bay area there.
Oh, yeah.
But that's where the book was talking about North Beach. And if you look at it on the map, as a matter of fact, Google Earth it. I put it in the Google Earth map search, and North Beach was the Queens area. And the Queens area, of course, is where LaGuardia Airport is.
Now, isn't the original terminal there, the ones the Clipper
sure,
ship?
Sure, it sure is. Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah. So
well, the original terminal was a Pan Am terminal over here.
Yeah.
It's on the other side of the LaGuardia Airport today.
Yeah.
Right, and I think it's still standing, isn't it?
It was the New York... The terminal's there. It's a private aviation terminal now. But it's
right.
Where Pan American launched all their seaplanes for Europe.
Right. I remember being inside there. They had the rotunda.
Yeah, that's right. It was changed to LaGuardia Airport. Was it 1939 they changed the name? Steve, do you remember?
Edmund Thompson?
Yeah, Steve Thompson. I can't remember when.
No, I'm not that old now. I don't remember that.
Yes, you are.
Well,
nice call. Nice
yeah,
call.
We have another area code here. I don't know if you want to talk to us or not, but area code 516. Who do we have at 516?
This is Bill Hirsch, Neil.
Hey,
hello,
Bill
Hirsch. So good to hear from you.
How you doing?
Doing fine. This is Eastern's historian, yeah. Bill Hirsch. And, Bill, you're up in the New York area.
Yep, and I just wanted to go back to the Curtis Condors for a minute. And he mentioned about that seaplane one that's buried in the ice.
Yeah.
Right. Well,
There is a gentleman who has been down with National Geographic, and they are researching the possibilities of raising that airplane.
Yeah, that would be Dick Newman. He's involved in that. I'm familiar with that rescue effort.
Yeah. And the terminal at LaGuardia, the old marine terminal, has all been restored.
Really? It's a museum,
yes,
isn't it?
A beautiful job.
No, I think it's General Aviation, didn't it?
Yeah, but it's all been, all the inside, all the ceiling paintings and everything have all been restored.
Yeah, I think it was probably built for Pan American at the time.
Yeah, it was, originally, yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's really fallen into some real bad condition, and about 3 years ago they went in there and the Port Authority started restoring it.
Amazing. I remember back in the 70s accumulating flight hours in a Beech-18 carrying the mail from Boston to New York and back 5 days a week.
Oh.
Well, get you back.
You would have fit right in with the guys that had to fly, that were assigned to fly on the shuttle.
Well, getting back to the days of the Condor, flying from New York to Miami, wow. We had two bases. Initially, we had New York to Richmond, and then we extended on down to Atlanta. And then, when we talk about Frank Giardone, Frank was only with Eastern Air Transport for a couple of years. And Frank just couldn't get along with Charlie Dolan, who at that time became the operations manager, ground operations manager. But Harold Elliott hired Frank because Frank was, the equivalent of the FAA. He was one of their inspectors for the civil aeronautics. I'm not certain what they called it back in the 30s. I don't know whether it was a CAA or not, but I think it's
Department of Commerce.
Department of Commerce. And
yes,
Frank
Jerry
worked for them. And he had
one of them.
Yeah, he had quite a bit of experience when Harold Elliott hired him. And he basically called. Frank heard that Eastern Air Transport was going into the passenger business, and so he called because he heard that Harold Elliott, and he knew him just kind of, hello, Harold, that type of thing. And Harold Elliott was a Navy pilot, and when Harold got him on the phone, he said, "Well, do you want a job?" And he said, "Yeah, that's why I called." And he was hired the very next day. Frank Giardone was, and it was just a couple of days of operating the passenger carrier with Pete Parker, because there were only two pilots when they started the passenger service, and that was Pete Parker, H.E. Pete Parker, and of course Frank Giardone. And Pete was the chief pilot, and then they put Frank Giardone down in Atlanta to become the first chief pilot down in that area. But just an interesting thing about Frank and the experience that he had, because I advertised the fact that we were going to talk a little bit about Eastern Air Transport's and Eastern, I guess we could say Eastern Passenger Operations first emergency. The very first emergency was with Frank Giardone. And when they started the first service from New York to Atlanta, Pete was in one airplane and Frank was in the other airplane. And they stopped along the way. They actually stopped in Washington, D.C., because Harold Elliott was going to attend some banquets and some functions for the Postmaster General at that time. And so they made the stops all the way down. And in Spartanburg, they stopped and picked up some correspondence, news correspondence. Well, one of the news correspondents was Ernie Pyle. Ernie Pyle, which was the famous war correspondent, he became the war correspondent, and he was one of the newsmen that was on that flight. And they had a full load of 18 people on the airplane. And so they took off from Spartanburg, headed to Atlanta, 18 people on the airplane. And when they boarded, Frank saw a pilot there that he recognized as a Mr. Doug Davis. And, of course, every pilot, of course, with Eastern Airlines knows who Doug Davis was. And at that time, he was a famous racing pilot. Well, Doug recognized the fact that, Frank recognized the fact that Doug had more experience than his co-pilot. Because in those days, if you had soloed an airplane, you could be a co-pilot for the airline.
Oh, really?
Just by having the fact that you'd soloed.
Oh, wow.
So, at any rate, I guess Frank felt a little bit more comfortable with Doug Davis sitting in the right seat. So he asked Doug to come up and fly with him, and so Doug did. And when they were approaching Atlanta, they were right about Stone Mountain. One of the correspondents came up to the cockpit and tapped Frank on the shoulder and said, "Sir, your right landing wheel is hanging down below the fuselage belly." And so Frank said, "Well, just a minute, Doug. You fly the airplane, and I'm going to go back to the passenger side, and I'm going to look back, and I'm going to check it out." And sure enough, he came back, and the wheel strut had actually broken, and the wheel was hanging down like a broken arm.
Oh, my.
So here they had, and by the way, at the receiving end in Atlanta, they had celebrities all lined up in the stands welcoming the first passenger flight into Atlanta. So all of these dignitaries, the governors, the mayors, and all that, had turned out to meet the flight. Well, Pete's airplane had already landed. And here Frank and Doug Davis were in the airplane, and Doug had to think fast because they were quickly approaching the Atlanta airport. Of course, it wasn't the Atlanta airport in those days. It was Candler Field. And so Doug, knowing Candler Field, because being from Atlanta, they flew over and they chose a spot to land the airplane on the turf. And so Frank decided that, well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to land the airplane as slow as we can. I'm going to land the airplane on the left main gear. And then when it starts to settle, when the tail starts to fall down, he says, "I'm going to hit the left brake and I'm going to apply full right throttle. Because if I don't, we're going to ground loop. The airplane, as soon as it hits the wing, is going to cartwheel off to the right toward the broken landing gear, and they would be immediately on their back, possibly hurting some passengers, 18 people on the airplane, plus the hostess and the two of them." And so they did that. They came in. He lined up with the turf and put it down on the left gear. And he said, Frank, in his book, by the way, Pilot of Fortune, that was the name of his book by Frank Jardone, said it was the best landing that he had ever made before that time and after that time. He touched down at about 47 miles an hour, and the tail started to fall down like a tailwheel airplane would do. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, he hit the left brake, which was a brake handle. He hit the left brake and applied right throttle, and the airplane almost immediately stopped in the turf.
Really?
Oh, my.
The passengers got off the airplane not even knowing that they had been through an emergency landing.
It's amazing.
With one right wheel completely up into the motor nacelle, the engine nacelle of the airplane. It had lodged up into the nacelle there. And so I thought that was pretty heroic. But also Ernie Pyle, the war correspondent, on the airplane when they landed, like I say, the celebrities and hardly anyone actually knew that they had had a major problem. And it could have been a major disaster with death. As a matter of fact, Frank said it could have easily have caught on fire.
That's right.
But I wanted to read to you just this little passage that Ernie Pyle wrote in the Daily News that he was writing in Washington, D.C. He said the opening of Eastern Air Transport's passenger air service between New York and Atlanta saw what flyers term one of the finest pieces of piloting ever done in aviation. Frank Jerdone, one of Eastern Air's pilots who will fly the Atlanta-Miami run, was the hero of the occasion. Jerdone, by a skillful one-wheel landing at Candler Field, averted a serious accident and brought 17 people to the ground without even shaking them up. There have been scores of such one-wheel landings, but never before has a pilot been faced with the task of preserving the lives of 17 passengers in such an emergency. And it goes on to say that the future famed correspondent did not overlook the passengers whose lives were saved in that article. And if those people, said Powell, ever forget the name of Frank Jerdone, they are ungrateful wretches. So that's my story. Can any of you top that one?
No, that's untoppable. That's just pretty untoppable,
Neil.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know, Steve. Your L-1011 glider flight was pretty untoppable too.
Amazing.
Well, and that was a planned skill, and mine was unplanned. So.
I have a question of Steve.
Yeah.
Steve, when you mentioned the loss of oil in those engines, I'm befuddled. Why didn't someone notice that there was a drip of oil now and again to make someone aware of the problem?
The only place that you could have found that would have been on the ground and after the engine was running. And it would have been a mist, so nobody would have known about it. There was no way that you could see it.
Well, because there was pressure behind the oil, was there, causing the mist?
Well, simply it was in the thrust of the engine. It would have been internal.
Okay.
And there would have been no way that you could have seen that. It would have come out as a mist because it was such a small orifice that the O-rings had. So there would have been no way that you could see it.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for clarifying that for me.
Plus, I do believe the oil is clear in color because it's synthetic. Mm. It's not like engine oil.
That's right.
Yeah, so it would be very almost impossible to see. And I do believe the oil, on a lot of jet engines, the oil is pumped by the main bearing, the Labyrinth seal air, and oil does not return to the tank. It's pumped overboard. So it'd be hard to tell the mist. You couldn't tell if it was a normal venting or if it was a leak.
Thank you.
Yeah. Bill Hirsch, how's things going with the DC-7B Foundation? Are you still there, Bill?
Yeah, Neil, I'm here.
Yeah, how are things with the DC-7 Foundation?
Doing pretty good. I wanted to let you know so you can tell people. On Friday, November 18th, Captain Sully Sullenberg is going to fly the airplane from Opa-locka to Charlotte, and they're going to put it in the hangar with his airplane. And it'll be on display at Charlotte Airport for probably about 3 or 4 weeks.
Very good. That's
so it'll
great...
be an open house
Bill,
thing.
But, Bill, this is Steve Thompson, and I have a question for you.
Yes, Steve.
Is he going to put up the same amount of money that you told me I had to put up in order to get a type rating and fly that airplane?
All I know is he's booked the entire airplane. He's bought 40 seats on the airplane.
Wow. Yeah.
Bill, this is Jim Hart on the Vineyard calling.
Hey, Jim, how you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. Just one question. Do I understand that the DC-7 will be at the Stewart Air Show on November 11 and 12?
They haven't verified it yet.
Okay.
But
thank
I'll
you.
Let you know as soon as I know.
Very good. Thank you.
All right. Also, on September 25th, Sunday, that new show is going to be on television on ABC, but I don't know whose channels are in different areas, with called Pan Am. And that is the it's a segment show, and it's our airplane that's going to be on with the Pan Am colors on it because they used that for the filming of the show.
Right. I understand it's getting a lot of publicity right now, preparing for that show.
Yes, yes, a lot of publicity.
What's the date again?
September 25th will be the first episode.
Thank you.
So. Actually, they asked me to play one of the parts, but, you know, but in talking with Jim Hart, because he is my advisor, we turned that down, didn't we, Jim?
I think we did, Margaret, but there was only one hitch. I think it had to do with the uniforms, didn't it?
I think so. I mean, you know, it was not short enough. You know, it was kind of long.
Well, they used Pan Am uniforms on the girls.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, it's a nice color. It's blue.
Oh, yeah.
I think they're pretty.
Yeah. But, no, it's been doing quite well. So.
Steve Thompson?
Yes.
This is Steve, the other Steve the Lesser.
Hey, Ben Steve Aiken. From Gainesville, Georgia, too. I know.
Lake City,
yeah,
Florida.
Right. Yeah, that's right. I used to be there, too. I had a hangar at Gainesville. Ben Aiken is who I was thinking of at Delta Air Base. Took me a while to think of it.
Oh,
yeah. No, Ben really didn't have anything to do with that, at least when I was over there. He didn't have anything to do with that airport. Aubrey Sweezy spent more time over there than anybody else.
That's
but,
right.
But, again, the owner of the operation was not he was not an Eastern employee or a pilot. As a matter of fact, he was a non-pilot, period.
Oh, okay.
I was trying to think of his name.
Yeah. It only took me 20 minutes to think of Ben Aiken.
I've been communicating with his son, by the way, on Facebook.
Uh-huh. Yeah, okay. Yeah, he's still in Gainesville.
Yeah. Well, the Condor... I think about 1 year after the initial passenger service went into service, they put an autopilot on that Condor. It was a Sperry auto. They call it the automatic pilot, Sperry automatic pilot. And they put that Sperry unit in the Condor so that the pilots could, once they took off and got to cruise altitude, they could turn it on. And the airplane could actually fly a course, a true course, and keep the airplane flying stably, and even in rough air. I think it was about the second or third flight. Another Eastern pilot, right after Frank and Pete were hired, and I can't think of his name now, was the pilot that flew that first flight with passengers, and they went all the way up to Washington, D.C., rather. And they were, for the most part, in the clouds or in the fog and rain. And so the airplane performed, or the autopilot performed pretty well under those conditions.
Amazing. How many Condors were made?
Steve, how many airplanes did we have?
How many did we have? We had 15 total of the 65 total that were built. Most of them went to the military. After Eastern sold theirs, I'm sitting here looking at the Condor list, and I'd say most of the Eastern airplanes went to England as military airplanes.
What were they used for? Were they troop transports?
Yeah, troop transports. A lot of the Central and South American countries, Chile, Argentina, three of them went to Antarctica. China bought a bunch of them. Let's see, where else? Yeah, China National Airline. Americans' airplanes went to China. Mm-hmm. Colombia had airplanes. The U.S. Navy had, I don't know, half a dozen or more. Peru had a bunch of them. Argentina, as I said. So that it was a variety. Curtis didn't build a whole, I mean, based on today's numbers of airplanes, I guess 65 airplanes was a lot of airplanes back then. And they were all built, if I remember right, at Garden City in Long Island, right across the Queensboro Bridge in New York City. I think that's where they were built.
Yeah.
I don't have that written down. It's just something that sticks in my mind. That.
And I understand that they have no remains. There's no. They're all cut up.
No, there's one remaining. A Air Cal guy. It was American Airlines named Dick Newman, who's out in Arizona. He's got serial number 23. It was originally an American Airlines airplane, and it crashed in Albany, New York, December 31st, 1934, in a snowstorm. And American got the engines and the landing gear and just abandoned the airplane. And Dick, years later, went out there and recovered the airplane and hauled it over, and it sat in a hangar in Midway for years, Midway Airport in Chicago. Really? And that's where I ran across Dick, was when the airplane was at Midway. He's moved it down to Arizona and is rebuilding it as we speak.
Wow.
Yeah, wow was right, because
amazing.
It's a monumental rebuilding.
Yeah,
I bet it is.
Well, you know, we're getting close to the time we're going to be signing off here in just a minute, but it's really fun to talk about some of these airplanes that Eastern Airlines owned in the past. I'm kind of having fun doing some research and then putting together a little skits about it, about the various types of airplanes. And so we've got quite a few more to go, and then we'll run out of airplanes eventually, I guess. We'll talk about the 757, my all-time favorite. And, of course, we had a 747, the DC-10. We had the DC-9 and DC-8. So we've got many airplanes to review in our future shows. Margaret, you've got something I want to have you remind the folks again about.
Yes, I just wanted to remind everyone that Mr. Hall, Floyd Hall, does enjoy hearing from his Eastern family. And I wanted to give his address again. Please send him letters. He really cannot reply to your letters or your cards, but it does mean the world to him. We have heard that. And he is a young 95 years of age. So here is his address. Please send those letters and cards. Please address them to Mr. Floyd Hall, Merton's House. Let me spell that. MERTENS, Merton's House, 73 River Street, Woodstock, Vermont, zip code 05091. Now, you can also find his address in our Radio Club newsletter on the website. And, of course, our website is www.ealradioshow.com. I'm sure he would appreciate that.
Steve or Jim, do you have some comments or any announcements or anything? Anything spectacular happening up at Martha's Vineyard that
no,
we don't
Neil,
know
I
about?
I just received my Keeping in Touch newspaper, and that was a very nice article on the EAL radio program that you had put in there. And I hope so many people will read it and respond. To me, it's one of the things that keeps us all together, and it will even solidify more so all of us who enjoy being a part of Eastern Airlines and a part of this program.
Actually, I wanted to share something with all of you just to show you how much this radio show is being listened to. I was teaching a class today. I was subbing for an instructor, and so I was lecturing for 8 hours. About 2 hours into the lecture, one of the ladies in the class said, "Your voice sounds so familiar. I think I've heard you before." And she said, "Are you on a radio talk show?" And I said, "Well, it's funny you should ask that. I'm on the EAL radio talk show." And she said, Oh, my gosh, I just listened to that on Monday night." And I said, "You did?" And she said, "Yes. And you play that other kind of character." And I said, "Well, is it Luann? Is that the one you like?" And she said, "Oh, I love it. I love it." And she said, "Oh, I love that show." She said, she didn't tell me how she found out about it, but she loves all of you. So I just wanted to pass that along to you. What a small world this is.
Yeah, it is.
Now she's reached celebrity status.
I have.
There you go. Our lives will be hell from here.
Can I send her a lobster or two?
Do what?
Maybe I could send her a lobster. Insane.
Yes. And actually, you are my agent. So book those shows, Jim.
Hey, for lobster, I'll talk like Luann.
Well, just I want to remind our folks that we do have a travel center now, and it's open for business. of taking your reservations. It's on the homepage. We've got it there, so you can just click on the Travel Center little icon there, and it'll take you right to the travel page. And be sure to go to the website whenever you plan to take a trip, no matter whether it's for renting a car or renting a hotel or traveling around the world or on cruises or whatever. Whatever your travel is, just make sure you go to that travel, compare our prices, and check it out. I think they are very competitive with the other online travel businesses. And remember, every time you book through this online reservation center, you're going to be helping the radio show, because all of the income that is derived this way is going to help this show stay on the air. And just a reminder to the REPA members, if you are going to the Tampa convention in October, it'll be October 28th, 29th, and 30th, to that REPA convention at the Hyatt, Grand Hyatt there, why not go to our website? And if you're especially going to travel by flight or by air, rather, then check out the rates, and I think you'll be impressed. So do your shopping for your traveling on our website. And that website, again, is ealradioshow.com. And by the way, we have over 20 pages now for you to explore, and fascinating articles about history. Historian, I think, Steve keeps it with new history that we put on there. And did you have something?
Yeah, remember to try to attend as many luncheons around the country, Puerto Rico and Mexico. Get involved in Good Eastern Family Fellowship. We will be remembered for a long time if you can keep the Eastern legacy alive. Support EARA, REPA, the Silver Liners, and other organizations, websites, and shows like this radio show.
And speaking of the radio show, tell your friends about the show. Tell them to go to our website at www.ealradioshow.com. And there on the home page is a connection to the show every Monday at 7 p.m. East Coast time. They can also register as a club member and take advantage of the many interesting web pages, like the travel page Neil just mentioned, the historians page, the memorial page, the website, Great Eastern Video commercials, and Eastern People photo albums, and much, much more. And don't miss the website's newsletter of the most recent happenings.
Well, folks, that's about all we have for tonight. So be sure to tune in again next Monday at 7 p.m. when Eastern's Flight 33 will be taxiing from the gate. We don't know yet what type of airplane, but I'm sure it will be a very special and interesting show. That's our show for tonight. We hope you've enjoyed it. And so from the Eastern Radio Show and the Eastern family, where all the women are unequaled, all the men are good-looking, and all the children and grandchildren are above average, we'll say
good night, Margaret, Bud, and Steve.
Good night, Jim, Bud, Neil, Steve Thompson, and Steve McDonald.
Good night, Jim, Margaret, Neil, and Steve.
Good night, Bud, Jim, Margaret, Steve, and Lou Ann, wherever you are.
Well, good night, you all. Make sure you fly right side up.
Good night, Eastern family.
Good night, everyone.
Give me a ride to my home. I want to be there in the morning time. Oh, the morning sun does rise. I want to be back home once more. I've left my home. I left it far behind. I set out to find the right way for my mind. In here and there, I've been most everywhere.